something about best intentions? What's the matter? Oh, you were finished. Oh, well, allow me to retort. What does
Taylor
look like?
What?
What country are you from?
What?
What ain't no country I ever heard of? They speak English and what?
Woo, 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 what?
English, motherfucker, do you speak it?
Yes.
Then you know what I'm saying.
Yes.
Describe what
Taylor
looks like.
What? What?
Say what again? Say what again? I dare you. I double dare you, motherfucker. Say what one more goddamn time.
He's black.
Go on.
He's bald.
Does he look like a bitch?
What?
It's business time, baby.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
My client, Brock Lesnar, conquered the streak.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
You fat. You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
It is the final sound off of 2015. We have reached the end of the year. And this is actually episode 415 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off for Sunday, December 27th, 2015. I am the Solid Monster. 31 days until Lucha Underground Season 2 premieres on the El Rey Network, January 27th. There was a report this week that Lucha Underground may be looking to run shows in Texas during WrestleMania week, which makes me very happy. I hope that happens. And I hope that everybody who celebrated had themselves a very Merry Christmas. Kind of a mixed bag for me this weekend. Yesterday would have been my dad's 58th birthday. And first one since everything that happened earlier this year, which I've shared with you guys already. I speak for myself here, I just cannot wait for this shitty year to be over with. But on a lighter note, I saw the movie Sisters on Christmas Day, which is the movie that has John Cena playing a tattooed drug dealer. He did pretty good. Wasn't a huge speaking role or anything like that, but what they gave him, I thought he was very good. He was very entertaining, and I even joked to my friend. I said, you know, if now that they have Roman Reigns and he's kind of finally getting over in the role they wanted him to, if they wanted to budge at all in the future and actually considered moving John Cena over from babyface to heel, which they won't, I know that, but if they did, and he came out looking like he looks in this movie, all tatted up with the, you know, the little beanie on his head or whatever, he'd be the most over guy in the entire company. I think you wouldn't have anybody booing him in the audience. It was just, he looked, you know, just ridiculously jacked, wearing this this wife beater with this ridiculous-looking tattoo on his neck and his face. And, you know, he's the drug dealer, so whatever you want, he's got it. And he's rattling off the names of all the different things he carries, and I have a feeling that that was something of a reenactment of wrestling locker rooms back in the day. Hopefully not today, but back in the day, you probably had somebody like a John Cena kind of open up his little bag of stuff, his little briefcase, and say, all right, what do you need? Let me know what you need. I got it for you. Time is running out to nominate this podcast for the Wrestling Radio Awards. You can go to WrestlingRadioAwards.com and write in Solid Monster Sounds Off under the category for Show of the Year. So if you want to show us some love, I would very much appreciate that. Quick follow-up on the Podbean situation I mentioned at the end of last week's show, and some of you may have tuned out early and didn't even hear it. Many of you were upset that Podbean is now apparently forcing people to download their free app to stream the show. You know, you would be able typically on your mobile device to go to a page. You could download the actual MP3, and now they're trying to push the app onto you. The app is free. I have it. It's actually pretty good. I would recommend, you know, downloading it. You know, install it. If you don't like it, you can get rid of it. It doesn't cost you anything. But yes, they're being a little pushy by doing that, and people are upset. I said the only way to download the show now, if you wanted to, you could do it, but you'd have to do it on your computer. Then you can right-click Save As, get the show, and then you can always transfer it over to your device. Well, there are actually not one but two workarounds that you can, in fact, result in the download of the actual MP3 if you would like. First, many of you know, you can get the sound off on player.fm. That's one of the many ways you can listen to this podcast. If you go to the player.fm website on your smartphone, type in Solid Monster, you can bring up our latest episodes. You will see a yellow play button. You can download the MP3 by double-tapping on that play button. I had to kind of double-tap around the button, if that makes sense. I did get it to work, though. So, you know, if you tap it at first and it says open and not download, just keep trying. You can, absolutely, you can download it that way. So that's one way. The easier way is to do it through Podbay. You can go to podbay.fm. Podbay is a great site. You type in Solid Monster, bring up our show page. It's going to give you a listing of all of the episodes. Just tap on the episode that you want to listen to, and on each individual episode page, you will see a download button. Tap that, and voila, the download should begin. So fear not, you can still download the MP3 for each show on your phone or your tablet without having to install an app or do it on your computer first. I would recommend podbay.fm, but again, if you go to player.fm, it works just the same. So I just wanted to let everybody know there's no reason to panic or be upset. That is the workaround. Audible is still offering listeners of this podcast a free trial of their service for 30 days. You can sign up right now, get yourself one free audiobook using our URL, audibletrial.com/solidmonster. You got to go through the sign-up process. Then you can cash in on your free book, and they got tons of them. You can get Brock Lesnar's books, Shawn Michaels, Chris Jericho, Hulk Hogan, I mean, Dusty Rhodes. There's tons of wrestler books up there, and you can get it for free. Even if you cancel the trial during the 30 days, you get to keep your book. They don't, you know, take it back from you. We've had a very good year on Audible, and like to end strong. So if you haven't already done so, take advantage of that here in the next few days. audibletrial.com/solidmonster. And last but not least here, if you like what you hear every single week, you can make a PayPal donation to the show on thesolidmonster.com. This is the last week of the year here, so if you want to get those final donations for 2015 in, now is the time to do it. $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname. And I want to say thank you to everybody who made a donation this week, including Sean Williams, Out of Control Cody Thomas, Deadpool James Herrera, Malicious Intent Michael Cuomo, Ryan the Saint Santelli, Luis Hercules Hernandez, John Loose Cannon Lopez, Christopher Pimp Daddy Purington, Jerome You're Going Down Eugenio, Yvonne Bruiser Balak, Radiant Ray Wrighton, Michael Sergeant Pepper, Judge and Jury Justin Girardi, Flamethrower Stephen Fleming, The Rebel Stanton Riker IV, Ring Rage Robert Young, Mastodon Michael Brown. Check out his channel on YouTube, youtube.com/reviewkingmb. He's got tons of movie and TV reviews up there. The Roswell Renegade, Tom Quiet. Tom is hosting a fundraiser for an upcoming short film called Grappling Life. It's about a high school student who has cerebral palsy, and to try to fit in with his classmates, he joins the wrestling team. So it's being shot completely in New Mexico. They're looking for a little bit of help to cover some of the basic production costs. So if you would like to help and learn a little bit more about the movie, you can go to GoFundMe.com/West Oak Street. All one word. GoFundMe.com/West Oak Street. Thank you to everybody who, not only this week, but all year long. Again, these are completely voluntary. And so, you know, to everybody who's taken the time to go on the website and to donate any amount, no matter how little or how much, and some of you have blown me away with your generosity, so I just want to say thank you to every single person who donated this year. I mentioned last week I was going to be doing a Q&A exclusive to the TV Tracks channel on YouTube. That is now up, already 10,000 views deep and climbing, so you can head on over to the TV Tracks, TVTRAX channel on YouTube, and you will find my 90-minute-plus Q&A. It was like an hour and 36 minutes, like a bonus sound-off of doing nothing but answering your questions. So head on up there. There is no downloadable MP3 like you would normally find. That's on our channel. This is exclusive to the TV Tracks channel. And please head on over there, leave some comments, and check it out. We started last week our countdown. I said we're going to be doing a WCW Best Matches Countdown for 15 straight weeks, culminating on the anniversary of the final Nitro from 2001, the 15-year anniversary of the death of WCW. We're doing one match per week in no particular order. We kicked things off last week with War Games from Wrestle War 1991, a great match. And we are going to be doing match number two at the end of the show, which is probably even, and it holds up after all these years, been over 20 years. It is still one of the wildest, craziest matches I've ever seen. And it's a lot of fun, and so that'll be something to stick around for a little bit later. But before we do any of that, we're going to kick things off here with a different kind of countdown. I said last week that I was going to be naming my top 10 matches, my top 10 wrestling matches of 2015. Say what you want to, especially with WWE about this year, but there has been a lot of great wrestling this year. And I said, you know, I could just do a top 10 and not do it in any particular order. That's kind of the way I'm doing the WCW list. I said, you know what? I started putting the list together and I found myself ranking them, so I just decided to go ahead and rank them. So this is my ranked list. We're going to start from the bottom with number 10 and work our way up to number 1 of, in my opinion, the top 10 greatest wrestling matches of 2015. And this is not just WWE. This is WWE, TNA, Ring of Honor, Lucha Underground, New Japan. Okay, those are the promotions that I've included here. And, yeah, it's funny, when I put the list together, I looked at it and I realized that Okada appears on this list 4 different times. So I think we know who the superstar of the year was. But yeah, we're going to start from number 10 and work our way up. Number 10 is Okada against Roderick Strong. They had a match that aired on Ring of Honor television on October 7th. Which was, I believe, the same date as the TakeOver special, where they had the Iron Woman match. It was actually taped a few months earlier. They had their Field of Honor show here in Brooklyn at MCU Park, the minor league ballpark, back in August. And this was, again, I was, at the beginning, I was kind of on the fence, and then I said, nah, I got to go to NXT. So I went to the NXT show in Brooklyn at Barclays. I don't regret it at all. But this was the show I would have been at were it not for the NXT show. And Okada and Strong, they just had a great match. I mean, they're two of the best at what they do. I know some people will look at Roderick Strong and say, oh, there's nothing exciting about the guy. He's vanilla. But as a worker, he's awesome. I mean, Roderick Strong is one of the best just pure wrestlers, I think, out there right now. I mean, you can say what you want to about his personality or your character or whatever. And Okada is Okada. I mean, what more can I say? Like I said, he probably is, if he's not the best, he's certainly one of the best in the world right now. And they just went out there and had a kick-ass match, a stiff match. Not much else to say about it. If you never got a chance to see it, I would seek it out. It is well worth your time. So that's number 10. Number 9 is a 6-man tag team match from Ring of Honor TV. Aired on June 24th. It was actually taped from the Global Wars event. I think it was Global Wars Night 2, maybe, back in May. It was AJ Styles and the Young Bucks, representing the Bullet Club, against Okada, there's that name again, and Roppongi Vice, Rocky Romero and Trent Beretta. There have been a lot of six-man tag team matches in wrestling this year. WWE lives and dies by these six-man tags every week. And most of them really aren't that special. You know, they're good, whatever. Some of them are very good. But they all kind of blend together because they do so many of them. Ring of Honor is guilty of the same thing. I mean, they've also had a lot of multi-man matches over the year. But this match stands out to me. This was one of the more fun matches I saw this year. It was just a lot of wacky, indie insanity, I guess. So if you're not into that kind of thing, just the nonstop action and the spots and the moves, one right after the other, you'll probably hate this match. All I know is I watched this match, especially with the final 3 or 4 minutes, and it just blew me away. The finish was, and poor Trent Beretta had to take the brunt of all of this at the end. He took a spike pile driver. He was then passed on to Matt Jackson for the Meltzer driver, and then he got passed back to AJ Styles for a double super kick from the Bucks as, you know, Styles held him up, and then AJ hit him with the Styles Clash. It was one thing after another to this poor fucker. He was dead by the end of this. But the whole match, not just the finish, it was just insanity from start to finish and just a lot of fun to watch. And AJ and the Bucks together is always fun to watch. So again, just it kind of a random six-man tag, but this is the one that really stood out to me. And I think even when I reviewed it on the Sound Off, I remember raving about it. So if you never had a chance to see it, I don't know where you would go now to find it, but if you could find it, it was the June 24th episode of Ring of Honor TV. It was taped from Global Wars. I think it may have been Night 2. Just a fantastic match. Number 8, Prince Puma and Johnny Mundo, All Night Long from Lucha Underground, June 17th. This was the only match on the entire show. All Night Long is their version of an Iron Man match, so at the end of an hour, the man who has the most number of falls is declared the winner and the champion. Prince Puma here was defending his Lucha Underground title against Johnny Mundo. And they went the entire episode. And it was just a great match. Both these guys, again, are two tremendous performers. Johnny Mundo is a lot of fun to watch. Prince Puma, Ricochet, one of the best in the world. There are things that guy can do in the ring that just a human being should not be able to do. And they went out there, they told a story. I believe Mundo had gone up at one point, I think maybe 4-1 on Puma. And I know that, you know, that might be a turnoff for some people. Oh, it's so predictable, the babyface is down by so many falls. Obviously, he's going to play catch-up, he'll probably win in the end. I'm not saying it wasn't predictable, but predictable does not mean bad. This is predictable in a good way. They told a story here where the heel went up on the babyface, and it looked like, you know, Puma was doomed. And he scratched and clawed and fought his way back. Ultimately, he did win the match. They had this great sequence in there where they were brawling up one of the little aisleways they have there in the temple. And they have a band, like a house band that performs each week. Although the bands will rotate. It's not the same band every week. They brawled up onto the bandstand, which is very high up. They were using some of the instruments. They had like a whole stack of tables that had been set up down below. They took this insane bump off of where the band plays down through the tables. I mean, these guys killed each other here in this match. But it was great action, told a great story. Two of the best out there right now. And it absolutely belongs on this list, so I put it at number 8 on the list. Number 7, Sasha Banks and Bayley. 30-minute Iron Man match from NXT TakeOver Respect back on October 7th. What more can be said here? I mean, obviously, you know, spoiler, their first match is elsewhere here on this countdown. This was a great match. I still prefer the original just because, I mean, it wasn't as long. It wasn't 30 straight minutes. But there were things that match had that this one I felt was missing. And that happens sometimes when you have the rematch, right? When you have the sequel. It doesn't always necessarily live up to the original. I would even say the same thing about Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker. In fact, I think that's a great analogy to make to Bayley and Sasha here. Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker went out at WrestleMania 25 and had one of the greatest matches in the history of that company, and in my opinion, the best match in WrestleMania history. They came back the following year at WrestleMania 26. They had a very good match, but it was down a couple of notches from WrestleMania 25. It couldn't quite match the magic of that first match. I would say the same thing about this. Great match. They told a great story. Bayley fought her way back. She won with this brutal-looking submission. She looked like she was going to break Sasha's arm off. Sasha, for her part, great heel in this match. I love the part where she went out there and she grabbed the little bow out of Izzy's hair, the little girl, and she was mocking her with it and made her cry. I'm sorry, I just thought that was great because that's what a heel does. And I think Ric Flair told a story on his podcast. I mean, if you think that's bad, okay, if you're a newer wrestling fan or a younger wrestling fan, if you think, what a horrible thing to love, this little girl is crying, how can you love that? If you think that's bad, then let me tell you something. Ric Flair told a story on his podcast once, I think, of Bruiser Brody at some event, you know, back in the 80s, actually pushing a handicapped boy over in his wheelchair. I don't know if he was, like, in the crowd going crazy or what happened. And I don't think the kid was a plant or anything. He was this handicapped kid, special needs child, whatever you want to call them, that was in a wheelchair, like in the front row, and he actually tipped over the kid's wheelchair. I mean, you talk, now that, to me, you know, that's going a little too far. So, you know, before you get too upset about, she made a little girl cry, believe me, that's very tame compared to some of the things that happened back in the day. But I just thought it was a great follow-up effort to the first match. What I loved maybe more than anything was the post-match. It was very emotional. You know, both of them were in tears. The entire roster came out to applaud them on stage. Sasha was presented with this giant bouquet of flowers by William Regal and just collapsed in a heap. Bayley's in the ring crying and hugging Triple H. You know, and you could joke around and say that the reason Sasha was crying was because she realized that she had to go to the main roster. You know what? I'm sure that was part of it. She loves NXT. I'm sure she really didn't want to leave. So this was great. This was great. But I have that at number 7 here on my list. Number 6 was the triple threat match from the Royal Rumble in January between John Cena, Seth Rollins, and Brock Lesnar for the WWE World Heavyweight Championship. This is the match that should have won Match of the Year on Monday night at the Slammies last week. Got jobbed out. This was as good a triple threat match as you'll see. I still put The Rock, Undertaker, Kurt Angle one from 2002 at the top of my favorite list of triple threat matches they've ever done. But this was up there. This was great stuff. I think Lesnar at one point got taken out. When he came back toward the end of the match, I mean, he came back like a bat out of hell. You almost forgot about him, and he was suplexing everybody all over the place. And I love that finishing little sequence they did there where Rollins was coming off for the curb stomp, and Brock caught him in midair and just hurled him through the air for the F5 and got the pin. All these guys just worked very well together. I mean, again, triple threat matches are hard. I mean, I've never been in one, but, you know, guys have talked about it, and just the nature of how they work, it's hard when you have... you know, that third guy in there, and you know, one guy has to kind of take a little break on the outside and give the other two a chance to do their thing, and you know, they have their formula that they use for these things, but they pulled it off, and they peaked early. They had the, in my opinion, the WWE match of the year in January was this match. So definitely has a place on this list, but only number 6. That's how much good wrestling we had this year. Number 5 was Okada against AJ Styles at the New Japan Dominion Show, July 5th. Styles came in as the IWGP Heavyweight Champion, and he wrestled a 30-minute classic with Okada. That's what this was. This was as good a professional wrestling match as you will ever see. With maybe the greatest finishing sequence to a match that I have ever seen. I'm not even going to recap. I talked about this on the podcast, and so I want you to go find the match. Easiest way is to, you know what? This match alone is worth signing up for New Japan World. Sign up for New Japan World and find this match. Again, July 5th at the Dominion Show, and just watch it for yourself. Okada got the win in the end. He won the championship, and now, of course, he's heading into Wrestle Kingdom to defend his title against Tanahashi here in a few days. But like I said, this was as good a pro hard-hitting, you know, well-worked, fun crowd into it. It just, you know, built and built and built to that final little sequence at the end. And, you know, Okada got the big win with a huge rainmaker that turned AJ inside out. Great match. This is number 5 here on the countdown. Number 4, Okada again. I believe this is the last time he's on this list. Okada and Tanahashi. From Wrestle Kingdom 9, the beginning of the year. In my opinion, Tanahashi and Okada is the Ric Flair, Ricky Steamboat of this generation. And there are people who may disagree with this, but I would say even better than Flair and Steamboat. And I think a lot of people, and I'm not taking anything away from Flair and Steamboat. Flair and Steamboat was great. Okay, I'm not saying it wasn't. But there are people, you know, like, I admit I'm guilty of the same thing, okay? Everybody listen, it's a joke at this point. Everybody listening to this podcast knows how big of a fan I am of the 1992 Royal Rumble match. And in my opinion, there will never be another Rumble that can top it. In part because there's a lot of things they do now and the way they present their matches and commentary that just, I just don't like it. And I don't think there's anything they can do with the way they do things now that could top what they did in 92. But I am being a little close-minded when I say that, because who's to say 5 years from now, 10 years from now, they don't have a Rumble that's every bit as good, if not better, with all the star power, and maybe they have new commentators that actually don't get on my nerves. You know, it is possible that one day they could top themselves. But I think people kind of fall victim to the same thing with Flair and Steamboat. It's such a classic series of matches that they kind of hold it up here, where it's out of reach, and nobody could ever top it. This is the best ever, and it can never be topped. And I'm telling you, I think Tanahashi and Okada have them topped. if we're being honest with each other. Now, this was the seventh match that they've had together in the last 3 years, the one they had at Wrestle Kingdom at the beginning of the year. This is their second Tokyo Dome main event at this Wrestle Kingdom show, and Tanahashi has won both of them. They will meet again on January 4th, where I would presume Okada is finally going to exercise his demons and get the big win over Tanahashi. It seems like that's the story they've been telling, and they've been building it up for a long time now. Unlike WWE, I think New Japan tends to give people the payoff they're looking for. But this match was just incredible. Tanahashi, with all of his injuries, he's got a bad back and he's had neck issues, everything. I didn't think he was winning this match, let alone putting in the kind of performance that he did here. I mean, he impressed the hell out of me. There was one spot where, you know, his finish is the frog splash. He calls it the high fly flow. And we had like a dozen high fly flows it took to beat Okada in this match. But at one point, Okada's in the crowd, and you have to understand, if you haven't seen the event or you've never seen a New Japan show, at least here in the Tokyo Dome, when they brawled over the barricade at one point, there aren't any fans in the area there where they were, so it's kind of open. So I say it's in the crowd, but it's not like, you know, Okada's literally in the sea of fans. But he's way out there, over the barricade, in the audience area, and Tanahashi climbs to the top rope and just dives off and gives him a high fly flow from the ring basically into the crowd. Okay, now consider it again. This guy is 37, 38, a lot of injuries. Okay, he's kind of the John Cena, I guess, of New Japan in that way. And he's flying around like he's, you know, five or 10 years younger, and you would never know there's anything wrong with the guy. So, you know, again, he impressed the hell out of me. And then after the match was over, so Tanahashi gets the win. Okada is just, he's literally in tears, just inconsolable, trying to be consoled by Ghetto. They're walking to the back. Tanahashi's in the ring. He gets on the microphone. He's looking down the aisle, telling Okada, hey, listen, turn around. And basically to rub it in and tell him, you know, you're not ready for this yet, and saying stuff like that. Okada is just bawling his eyes out. Not something you would normally see from, you know, your main event guy, but you could tell. The thing I loved and appreciated about this match, besides how fucking great it was the fact that it felt like it means something. I mean, you look at Okada bawling his eye. Everything was building to this Wrestle Kingdom match at the Tokyo Dome. You got 50,000 people in that building. And these guys have had a rivalry going now for a few years. Again, this was the seventh match. They have their eighth match coming up now. And Okada fell short. And he just couldn't control his emotions. It just poured out of him. And I didn't point and laugh and say, oh, look at this pussy, he's crying. I thought to myself, you know, goddamn, this obviously meant a lot to this guy. And he fell short. And you know what? If I was in his position, I can't say that I wouldn't have reacted the same way. To me, it came off as very believable and very realistic. And it meant that it made that IWGP title feel special in a way that most companies here, and including the biggest company here, just isn't able to do. And I'm gonna rant a little bit about this when I get to the Raw review, but we had yet another. I mean, add this to the fucking list of examples on Raw last Monday night on that Slammy show when Sheamus, who just lost the WWE Championship to Roman Reigns the week before, and the very first appearance we see of this guy on the show, he was just out there in I think maybe Del Rio's corner with all of the other League of Loser guys, and he's out there with a giant smile on his face. I'm like, this fucking guy just lost the championship last week, and he comes out here, he's not demanding a rematch or anything, he's got a giant fucking smile on his face. I couldn't believe it. But that's a great example. It's not the first time they've done that, it's the most recent, but it's just a great example of what I mean. It's the difference just in terms of how they book, and in terms of how they book their championships. And it just means so much more when New Japan does it. So, you know, this was great stuff. I have no doubt their match coming up is going to be every bit as good, if not better. Okada, leading into this match here on this list at Wrestle Kingdom 9, he had promised a 6-star match. That's a bold prediction. He predicted a 6-star match. And, you know, I don't do star ratings, but if I did, you know what? It's hard to say that he wasn't far off from that prediction here. Now, these, the ones I'm about to do, are my top 3 matches of the year. the three matches that made me go, holy shit, as I was watching them, the matches that had me glued to my TV or standing up out of my seat in the arena. This was the most fun that I had watching pro wrestling all year. Number three, Nakamura and Ibushi from Wrestle Kingdom 9. This was a rematch from 2013, which I had not seen before this. Nakamura won that match, as he did this one, so he's now 2-0 up on Ibushi. This one was for Nakamura's Intercontinental title, and it was really a coming out of sorts for Kota Ibushi. Kota Ibushi is going to be a big star for New Japan at some point. He has wrestled a lot for the DDT promotion over there. I think he still does. Although he's out hurt right now. He's actually got a pretty serious injury right now. I think it might be like a disc injury maybe in his back, but he may be out for a while. But he has wrestled a lot of really bizarre comedy-type matches. Just go on YouTube and type in Kota Ibushi DDT. And I'm not just talking about the matches with Yoshihiko, the blow-up doll. I mean, look at some of the just bizarre shit that this guy has been involved in. He's very entertaining, but by no means is Kota Ibushi a comedy wrestler. Or at least after this match, I don't see how you could say that. I mean, this guy is the real deal. He's not the youngest guy in the world. He's already in his, you know, early to mid-30s, but I still think he'll end up, you know, as long as he can stay healthy, he'll end up being one of the big names in New Japan, kind of like Tanahashi and Nakamura are now. That's what Kota Ibushi can be within the next, you know, 5 years. This was just a spectacular match. I'm not going to recap every crazy, insane move that we saw here. It was my favorite of the entire Wrestle Kingdom 9 pay-per-view, which was the best pay-per-view all year in any promotion. And that's also on a show that had Tanahashi and Okada that I just talked about, and I still think this was the best match of the night. So that tells you something right there. That's number three. Number two, Phoenix and Mil Muertes. Grave Consequences from Lucha Underground back on March 18th. I remember when I reviewed, I had so much fun reviewing this match on the podcast after I saw it. This was just absolute destruction from start to finish. Katrina, who is Mil Muertes' woman, had been coming on to Phoenix for some time. Obviously, that ended up being a giant swerve at the end, but Mil Muertes was not happy with this guy. And he took all of his frustrations out on Phoenix here. He killed this guy. Grave Consequences is a fancy name basically for their own kind of casket match. I love even the presentation of it. They had the casket with all the spray-painted stuff on it. They had these, I can't really call them druids, but I guess maybe you would call them druids, you know, bringing the casket out. It just, I don't know, I enjoyed the presentation of it. The match itself, Mil Muertes just, like I said, I mean, he tore this guy, he literally tore his mask, he was ripping the mask off of his face, we saw, you know, part of his face was exposed, Phoenix is just bleeding all over the place. In the end, Phoenix got the win, Mil Muertes was thrown into the casket, the lid was shut, we didn't see him for several weeks, and when he came back, obviously he was even more of a destructive force. And as we speak, he is the Lucha Underground champion here heading into Season 2. But Phoenix and Mil Muertes was the first match, really the first match that I watched on Lucha Underground that made me, I don't want to say it was the first really great match, because I actually, there was another one that I'm going to mention in the honorable mentions here in a moment, but it was the first match that just maybe made my jaw drop. Maybe that's the right word for it. And I actually went and I rewatched it several times. I must have seen this match like five different times already. I can't say that I've done that with any other match, any other Lucha Underground match, at least up to that point. So if you've never seen any of Lucha Underground, my advice to you, because you still have time before Season 2 begins, start from the very first episode. I really wouldn't want you to skip any of them. But if I had to name one match or one moment and say, okay, this is the one that's really going to get your attention, you got to watch this, this is the match that I would recommend to people from the March 18th episode. So I just have nothing bad to say about this match at all. It was one of my absolute favorite matches of the entire year, second only to match number one. In my opinion, the match of the year in any promotion in 2015... And it is Sasha Banks and Bayley, one, from NXT TakeOver Brooklyn back on August 22nd. I had the great fortune of being in the Barclays Center live for that match. And again, I was at the beginning, I was kind of on the fence, and then I decided, no, I got to go to NXT over ROH. They were running in Brooklyn both on the same night. I couldn't be in both places at once. And so I made the decision to go to NXT, and I'm very happy with my decision, in large part because of this match. I think if it wasn't for this match, I might have actually regretted not going to the Ring of Honor show. But this match just changed all of that. As a match, okay, I can't sit here and put this match just as a pure wrestling match. I'm not saying that this was, you know, necessarily even better than AJ and Okada or Okada and Tanahashi, but to me, it's not just about that. This was a great wrestling match. On its own, as a match, it's a great match. But I think it was more just about the build-up to the match, the entrances, the match itself, the story they told, and then how they weaved some of those moves in there. You know, she was working on Bayley's fingers, right? Sasha was just being an evil bitch during this match. We have not had the chance yet to really see evil bitch Sasha Banks, like the boss character on Raw yet. We still have not seen that Sasha Banks, okay? She's not doing badly. She's not being jobbed out every week. She's not absent from television week after week after week. I wish they were doing more with her. I have every hope and expectation that they will here heading into the new year. And maybe she'll even win the championship at WrestleMania. But we have yet to see this version of Sasha Banks on the main roster. This, to me, more than the one with the fucking unicorn horn dancing and shaking her ass, which is great to watch. But more than that, this is the Sasha Banks, I think, that can really make the money and can be one of the biggest stars they have on that roster. This is the Sasha Banks I want to see ultimately on the main roster. And she's going after Bayley's hand. She's smashing it on the steel ring steps. And it works into the match later on. One of my favorite spots of the entire match before the finish was she's got Bayley locked in the bank statement. And Bayley is reaching for that bottom rope. And I think she's got the tape on her fingers and everything. She already had a broken hand. It was just a matter of Sasha kind of going after the injury or trying to re-injure it. And Sasha sees that Bayley is so close, her fingers are almost touching the rope, and she starts stomping on the hand with her foot, with her boot. Just great stuff. And then Bayley, of course, rolls through and reverses it on her, and the crowd is going crazy. I can tell you that as somebody who was in the building, as loud as it sounded on TV, it was every bit as loud, if not more so, in the actual arena. People were going nuts for this match. Like at a show in Brooklyn, certainly never has there been a women's match in WWE that has been as prominently featured as this one. And you really don't know. I mean, this is still new territory here. You know, you're still trying to get these women over as a serious attraction. It works at Full Sail for NXT, but you don't know if that's going to translate to an arena in Brooklyn, New York in front of 13,000 people. But this was an NXT audience. I mean, there wasn't a person in the building who didn't come to see not just Balor and Owens, but I think they came to see Sasha and Bayley. So they hung with them. They were with them every step of the way. And right up until that crazy reverse Rana off the top rope that almost broke Sasha's neck. If you've never seen the slow motion, somebody put it up on as a Vine video, the slow motion of Sasha landing. Because some people say, oh, she didn't land at her neck. It only looked like she landed on her. No, she landed right on the top of her head. And she's very lucky that she didn't suffer a more serious injury. But it looked fucking spectacular, you know, from where I was sitting anyway, and I was kind of up there. It was incredible, and nobody saw that coming, and it was a great move to finish on. I almost feel like if this were in Ring of Honor, and I love Ring of Honor, but one of the things I hate is you'll have a move like that in a match, and you're like, oh, that's the finish. How can this not be the finish? And the fucking guy kicks out. And the match goes on another, like, 3 or 4 minutes, and the guy ends up winning with a super kick. And it's like, really? I think we probably should have ended, you know, 3 minutes ago with that fucking unbelievable move that we saw, but it was just the perfect finish. Bayley got the pin. There were literally people crying. There were people with tears in their eyes. And, yeah, I'm not going to lie, I was one of them. I wasn't crying, but, you know, you watch that, and the way they sold it, and Bayley's in the ring crying, and this is her big moment. Bayley was always the one that people looked at, you know, in storylines with the character, and like, oh, she's not going to be champion. She's not championship material. Charlotte won the title. Sasha won the title. Actually, Becky never did, but all of these people were passing her by. They told this great story over a period of several months, and Bayley had to beat each of the horsewomen, the other ones, Becky and Charlotte, to even get this match. And I just think as a total package, when you look at the promo video that they aired right before the match, it was one of the best video packages that I've seen them ever produce for an NXT match. And I would even put it up there with some of the best WWE ones that they've done. Maybe not the best, but it was great. It was great, especially that moment where they showed the wacky balloons deflating just at the right moment in the video where Bayley, I think, was... when Bayley was at her lowest of lows, you know, the video package was just phenomenal. The entrances I thought were great. Having Sasha come out in that Escalade, it made it feel like a big, it felt like a legitimate main event, right? When was the last time they did an entrance like that for the women? You don't see a woman being driven out there in a fucking Escalade. They don't even give Alberto Del Rio his car anymore. So they went all out here to make this feel like a true main event. And some would say it was the real main event. As good of a match as Owens and Balor had, it could not live up to this match. This is the match that should have gone on last. It was like this was Rock Hogan from WrestleMania 18, and poor Balor and Owens got the Triple H Jericho treatment in some ways. Even being in the building, it just didn't have that same energy coming off that women's match. The match itself and the post-match. Now, I didn't know being in the building if that whole four horsewomen deal actually made it on the air. I thought maybe they cut away and that was just for us in the building. So I was very happy to see that that whole thing aired. And just to see all of them, you know, with the four fingers up and everything else, it was great. I can't say that there was anything, anywhere, let alone on a WWE show the entire year that could match the kind of emotion that this had. So this doesn't have to be, you know, a six-star match like that Okada match. The match itself was good enough. When you couple it with everything else, this was the match of the year. There just couldn't be anything else. This was the match of the year. So that's my top 10 list. Now, I do have five honorable mentions here. And there were a lot of great matches. I know I'm leaving a few out. You know, Sasha and Becky had a great match on one of the TakeOver specials. And Cena and Owens when they had that first match at Elimination Chamber. It was a great match, although I think it gets more love more just because Owens won. And that was a great moment, too. You know, that was a great way for him to make his debut on the main roster with a clean win over John Cena. But the five matches that I would cite here, Lucha Underground Aztec Warfare back on January 7th, Prince Puma won Aztec Warfare to become the first ever Lucha Underground champion. They basically did the Royal Rumble better than WWE does the Royal Rumble. In their version, it's pinfall or submission only. There's no over-the-top rope eliminations, which makes sense because you have a lot of high-flying moves off the top rope and stuff, and you'd really be limiting what these guys can do if you instituted an over-the-top rope elimination rule. And again, much like that all-night-long Iron Man match they did with Puma and Mundo, this was the only match in the entire hour. This took up the entire show. I think it was over 50 minutes long, and like I said, Puma got the win. He won the championship. It was a great, great match. And similar to that 92 Rumble I mentioned, one of the great things about it was, it wasn't just like, hey, let's have a Royal Rumble type match. There were storylines that were already developing over the last few months leading up to this, and there were so many different stories with the different participants in the match. So, you know, there was stuff with Sexy Star and Chavo and Blue Demon, I think, came back to get revenge on Chavo, who had taken him out, and they had a lot of different stories weaved into this one match. That made it so great. Another honorable mention. I feel like I have to give some love to TNA here. They're kind of left out here. They were shut out of the top 10. But EC3 and Rockstar Spud had a hair versus hair match on Impact back on March 13th when I actually was still watching Impact. I didn't give up on it until a few months later. That was a really great match. And again, it was a story that had been built up for a long time. It wasn't just two guys. They stuck in the ring together and said, hey, have a match. Spud had been with EC3 for a long time. EC3 turned on him, and it all built to this. It was a hair versus hair stipulation. I think they were over in the UK, so they were in front of Spud's hometown fans, I think. He bled a gusher in this match. I mean, Spud's got blood. He's wearing the crimson mask, and he's fighting back, and he's fighting back, but ultimately EC3 beat him with the one percenter. And then EC3, the great heel that he is kind of feigning concern for Spud, and he gets on the mic and says, Spud, look, you know, I've got all this respect for you, and I'm not going to cut your hair. And of course, he turned on the fucker, and he ended up shaving his head anyway. So that's the one TNA match this year that really does stand out to me, and I thought it deserved a mention here. Brock Lesnar and Roman Reigns from WrestleMania 31 surprised me. I didn't think it was going to be as good as it was, and that also deserves a mention. They had a hell of a match. John Cena and Kevin Owens 2 at Money in the Bank. I thought their second match, the one at Money in the Bank, was better than the Elimination Chamber match, and so I put that here in the honorable mentions list. And last but not least, John Cena and Cesaro. They had a 30-minute match for the U.S. title on Raw back on July 6th. That was a hell of a match. I know they had had one match, I think, on Raw before this that was also very good, but this one was a match that you should go out of your way to see. And again, makes me very frustrated that there was no real follow-up after this with Cesaro. As good as he is, it's like, wow, we should do something with this guy. And they, you know, they really didn't. So those are your honorable mentions. That is your top 10 list of matches in wrestling for 2015. Hopefully mine is not all that different from yours. And if you've never seen some of these matches, well, consider that your homework assignment. I would strongly suggest you go find these matches because they are absolutely worth your time. One thing that is not worth your time was the Slammy Awards show. Last Monday night, Raw was live from Minneapolis, Minnesota. It was the annual Slammy show. And my question is this. If you have an award show, but largely nobody shows up to accept them, did it really happen? It's like the whole tree in the forest thing, right? All I know is this. Seth Rollins, on crutches, recovering from a torn ACL, a torn MCL, showed up at the Slammy Awards. He hobbled onto that stage, and yet no other top names could be bothered to show up. Or invited. Maybe they weren't invited. Maybe it's all WWE's fault. All I know is Seth Rollins, with a fucked up knee, just barely out of surgery, showed up to accept his Slammy Award, and well-deserved. Just the fact that he showed up, that alone earned him Superstar of the Year honors. The Raw Instapoll I put up on Twitter after the show was over 1,400 of you voted, 77% thumbs down, 23% thumbs up. The Slammys are a fail. Largely every single year, year after year, they do them. It just doesn't work. It would work better as its own standalone special. Now that they have the network, I don't know why they can't just rent out a fucking ballroom or something like they used to do back in the day. Everything with them now has got to be all big and fancy. Oh, we have the Hall of Fame ceremony, and so we want to sell 15,000 tickets, so we'll do it in a giant arena so that for, you know, at least a couple of the speeches, we have to stop and we have to boo all the idiots who are heckling in the crowd. And I'm with Chris Jericho on this, in that they shouldn't even invite fucking fans to the Hall of Fame if that's how they're going to behave. But I was perfectly fine with it when they used to do the Hall of Fames, and they would do it at like I said, like a small auditorium or a ballroom, or just not invite fans or invite a very small contingent of fans to kind of sit in the back. You know, in the late 90s, they had a couple of Slammy specials that were in a very small room like that, that they aired on USA. It was an hour-long special, and yeah, it was largely, you know, kayfabe, obviously, but they were entertaining. I don't see why they don't just do something like that now. They own their own fucking network. And look, if USA wants to air it, let USA air it. USA airs a lot of specials. They'll do a live SmackDown special. They do tribute to the troops. So maybe USA would air it on a different night. But that would be the way to do it. But, you know, they have 3 hours to fill on a Monday night. They need a gimmick. It's like when they used to bring back King of the Ring, right? Usually they would bring back King of the Ring as a gimmick to fill time on a three-hour Raw show. That's why they do it. But this was just a boring show. Nothing really happened. Sheamus was out there with the League of Nations, smiling, like I said earlier. Nothing ever happened. You would never know that this guy lost the top championship in the promotion the week before. This tough Irishman was beaten and deserves a rematch, by the way. Not that I want him to get the belt back, but he is, you know, he does deserve a rematch. That's their stupid rule they have. You automatically get a rematch. He's out there with, and maybe he was smiling because he knows he's going to get his rematch. God forbid the announcer should try to explain that. We could try to come up with this explanation on our own. I still don't know that I would be out there smiling like an idiot if I were in his shoes. I mean, it's like he should be out there on the microphone demanding a rematch now, tonight. I mean, Roman Reigns turned his back on Stephanie McMahon. He disrespected the owner of the company, or one of the owners of the company, at the beginning of the show, to where she was shouting. I had to mute the sound on my television. I couldn't just stand to hear it anymore. At her fucking worst, I don't know that Vicky Guerrero was as bad as Stephanie McMahon was in this opening segment. And she's yelling at Roman Reigns, get out of my ring, get out of my ring. And then he leaves, get back in my ring, get back in my ring. Don't you turn your back on me. And like a fucking pterodactyl. And she's yelling at this guy. And you would think, oh, she's going to really give it to him now. Sheamus deserves a rematch. So why don't we have fucking Roman Reigns with both arms tied behind his back in a cage against Sheamus for the championship? Nope. She puts Sheamus in a match with Dean Ambrose. It's like, okay. Whoop-de-fucking-do. Who gives a shit? Roman Reigns certainly didn't give a shit. He had a giant smile on his face. Now, they've already announced that Vince McMahon is coming back to Raw this Monday, so maybe they're going to wait and let Vince be the one to tell Roman, you know, on the first Raw of the new year or something like that, you will defend your title against Sheamus, and maybe then he'll stack the deck. I hope so. I hope so, because that would actually make sense, and Sheamus has to have his rematch, and so it's like ripping a Band-Aid off your arm, right? This is painful, but let's just get it over with, and then let's leave Sheamus in the past and move on to something else. So we'll see what they have up their sleeves with Vince. The Slammy Award winners, or the Shammies is what they should have been called. I don't know what is wrong with some of the people who are voting here. Obviously, it's just kids. It's got to be just kids voting for the most popular people. The voting by all accounts is legitimate. I know there are a lot of people who think the fix is in and they're fixing the votes. And look, I'm not going to sit here and tell you that they're not doing that for sure. But every year we go through this and there have been people that write for the company that no longer work for the company and have no reason to defend the company. And even they say that the voting is legitimate. So assuming that it is, it's just, you know, it's fans, it's kids that are just voting for, you know, the people that they like. Because some of these awards just didn't make any sense. So you have the, you know, the superstar of the year turned out to be Seth Rollins, and deservedly so. Like I said, Seth Rollins, just for showing up, deserved to be superstar of the year. But if you look at the year he had from cashing in Money in the Bank at WrestleMania and winning the championship, holding the championship for the majority of the year, at SummerSlam, he ended up with two belts and, you know, whatever your thoughts may be of Seth Rollins, and it was got boring with him as champion, or his promos are dull, all of that may well be true, but there isn't anybody else on that roster, in my opinion, unless you want to make the case for, like, Brock Lesnar, who really fit the bill as the so-called superstar of the year. So I had no problem with that. Match of the year, I did have a problem with. They had Undertaker and Brock Lesnar at Hell in a Cell. The match was damn good. I'm not denying that, but by no means was it the match of the year. And given the choices here, it absolutely should have been the triple threat match from WrestleMania. Or from, the Royal Rumble. Breakout star of the year was Neville. Should have been Kevin Owens. Diva of the year was Nikki Bella. And that's fine. She can have the Diva of the Year title. The female of the year in that company, without question, was Bayley. But they didn't include any NXT people, which is probably a good thing they didn't, because I have a feeling, had they included NXT people in many of these categories, it might have been an embarrassing night for the main roster. So Diva of the Year is fine. They can give that to Nikki. And really, if you think of that whole Diva label, she probably is. Of all the divas they pushed and everything, she probably was their Diva of the Year. But like I said, Female of the Year, of any female performer in that company, it was Bayley. Tag Team of the Year was the Usos, who were not even on television for half the year. Jimmy Uso spent half the year doing commentary, I think, on SmackDown. New Day clearly was robbed of this award. And you know what? This one surprised me most of all. For the reasons I just mentioned, the Usos, you know, weren't even around for half the year. The New Day was like a fucking revelation on television this year. If not the, certainly one of the most entertaining things about the show every week is the New Day. And the New Day, you know, they'll get booed by some people, like good heels, and they'll also get cheered. It's a mix of, it's like, they're the kind of heels that you like to get behind, I guess, if that makes sense. So the fact that they're heels, I didn't necessarily think that would work against them in the fan voting. So that is kind of what surprised me the most about that. Rivalry of the Year, Undertaker and Brock Lesnar, which makes sense. I'm fine with that. They also had another award. the Hero Among Us Award, which is basically just glorifying different people in the company for all of their charity work. Now, if you're going to do that, I think it would have been cool for Titus O'Neil to win the award because the guy does a lot of positive stuff. And now you're starting to hear about it, but he also does a lot of stuff you don't hear about. And so does John Cena. John Cena's been doing that for years. For all the stuff they shove down your throat about John Cena's work with Make-A-Wish and Susan G. Komen, there is a lot of stuff that John Cena does that we don't know about. And you know, I'm not taking anything away from him in that respect. It would have been nice, though, for Titus to get the award. But yeah, they had Stephanie McMahon as one of the nominees in this category. They had Stephanie McMahon as a nominee on a show where she physically assaulted one of her employees. Poor Tom Phillips at the end of the show got the shit slapped out of him by Stephanie McMahon. But, you know, we're supposed to suspend our disbelief for that one slammy category, I guess. It's like, it felt so out of place. It was so stupid. And it wasn't just stupid because Stephanie was a nominee. I don't know, the whole thing just, it felt wrong to me. It just doesn't feel right. You got the fans voting, which person does the most charity work? Let's give them a trophy. I mean, doesn't that defeat the entire purpose of doing charity work in the first place? I mean, I know. They do videos every week, you know, blowing themselves about all the charity stuff. There's nothing new. Okay, I understand that. But just as a slammy award, especially on a, yeah, this is all, it's all worked. It's all these kayfabe categories, LOL moment of the year and match of the year. But then you put like a quote-unquote real award in there. Like, it's like the equivalent of the Warrior Award almost at the Hall of Fame ceremony. It just, it felt out of place. But again, remember, philanthropy is the future of marketing. Remember that? That infamous tweet from Stephanie. She heard that at some conference somewhere and she tweeted it out. So that gives you some insight into where they're coming from with this, you know, philanthropic stuff here. They did yet another eight-man tag on the show, Team ECW against the Wyatts. This time they didn't even go a full 3 minutes. Actually, I guess it was Kane. It was Kane and Tommy Dreamer and the Dudleys, not Rhino, but it's the same fucking thing. I don't know why we needed this after the Wyatts quite definitively beat the ECW crew in an Extreme Rules match in Philadelphia, no less. That's a pretty dominant win. That's a pretty big statement they made the week before. This looked to me, you know, that match in Philly was the exclamation point on this feud. Or at least it seemed that way to me. It's just, it's the law of diminishing returns. Okay, the more you do something, the less it means. This match was not necessary. I'm looking up and down this card here. You know, honestly, there's really nothing else worth talking about from Raw last Monday other than the main event. It was Sheamus and Dean Ambrose in a cage match. Stephanie McMahon, again, this was her revenge on Roman Reigns for disrespecting her at the beginning of the show. It's a pretty good match. League of Nations got involved. Roman showed up to take him out. Came down to Ambrose and Sheamus. They both climbed over the cage. They were fighting on top of the cage. They're trying to climb down. They're punching each other and kicking each other and slugging it out. And Ambrose falls to the floor first, so he gets the win. Reigns and Ambrose stand tall to end the show, which again, I'm sure means bad news is coming for them. Vince McMahon coming to Raw Monday night, that can't be a good thing. John Cena also makes his return to Raw this Monday. He'll be facing Alberto Del Rio in what I presume is a non-title match, since they never once played up the championship in promoting the match. But then again, that never stopped them from, at the last minute, changing plans and could very well end up being a championship match, so we'll see. So they got Vince, they got Cena. They're trying to load up. I haven't checked to see what football game is this Monday, but there must be a good one. There's got to be a reason why they're loading this show up here. This will be the last Raw of 2015, which is a year, in terms of Raw, I think a year that this company probably wants to just put behind them and hope for better things in 2016.
I'm actually not wearing pants, and that's how I watch NXT every single week.
This was the other hour of TV that NXT taped while they were over in London, so they still had the hot UK crowd. If anything, they might have been even hotter, because they taped this episode largely before the TakeOver special. I think everything except the Sami Zayn match was taped before they went live on the air for TakeOver London. Show opened with the highlight of the night, a fatal four-way tag team match with Blake and Murphy, the Hype Bros, the Vaude Villains, and my favorite tag team in the world at the moment, Jason Jordan and Chad Gable, who were insanely over in that building. Really, if it wasn't for this match, this show would have been a thumbs down for me. It was just mostly videos and recap packages. This match, though, was tremendous, especially when Jason Jordan's, he has that hot babyface comeback at the end now of most of their matches. Everyone cheers for Gable. I mean, they're there to see Gable, but Jordan has really found his groove as part of this team. You know, he was around for a while. I still remember when I first saw him come into NXT, and he had the giant afro, and, you know, he changed his look. He has found some personality that I think he was lacking before. And he and Gable, they go together like peanut butter and jelly here. I mean, they just have gelled so well. They both, I think, each one of them makes the other better. And that's the making of a great tag team right there. You know that with Jordan, when he has that comeback, he pulls those straps down like Jerry Lawler back in the day. And you know that business is about to pick up. He's got a fire to him now that he didn't have before. They hit their move on Blake. I think it was Blake. Tossing him into the air. Gable catches him on the way down into the bridging pin. I like the 10-man tag on Ring of Honor better, that I'm going to review a little bit later, but this was still a great match. The Drifter, Elias Sampson, made his re-debut on NXT, beating Bull Dempsey with an elbow off the top rope. He then played his guitar after the match. I was not impressed by this performance, but it's his first match back, so I will give it time. And Sami Zayn made his long-anticipated return to NXT, his first match since May, when he tore his rotator cuff, swinging his arms wildly around before his U.S. title match on Raw against John Cena. Sami Zayn would be on Raw as we speak, were it not for that injury, so now he has to work his way back up. There's some rumors that maybe they're going to build to a Balor-Zayn championship match WrestleMania weekend in Dallas. I guess we'll see. I'll be at that show, so that would be a hell of a main event. He wrestled Ty Dillinger, who got in a ton of offense before Zayn made his comeback. Blue Thunder Bomb, which I've missed. Only he got a near fall with it. He won with the Huluva Kick. After the match, Zayn cut a promo in the ring promoting NXT, thanking the fans. He promised to have a great 2016. You and me both, my friend. Let's hope it works out that way. It's good to have Sami Zayn back on the show. Hopefully we get a Tommy back soon, and yeah, once that happens, they'll have a pretty good, solid core of top guys again on this show, which they need. You know, they've lost in this year some of the big names they've lost. Kevin Owens, Neville, Breeze. I wish they would get Breeze back at this point, just looking at what they're doing with him on the main roster. So when those guys go, you've got to have other people at the top to kind of replenish with. And they've got heel Samoa Joe, which hopefully they could still take advantage of that. And again, you couple him with Zayn and Balor and a Tommy and... I don't know what they're doing with James Storm, if they're going to maybe give him a little bit of a push. And I think there's still a chance we see somebody like an Austin Aries coming into NXT. So I think the future looks pretty bright for the NXT brand heading into the new year. Ring of Honor. This was a show highlighted by a really fun main event. Kevin Kelly also interviewed Steve Corino, who came out sporting a neck brace after his recent surgery. I think he had fusion. He vowed revenge on BJ Whitmer when he is ready to come back. And the main event is really the only thing worth talking about here. The main event was a 10-man tag Christmas surprise, which is very similar to the wild card match that WWE did at the 1995 Survivor Series, where the heels and the babyfaces are paired off at random. Only this was not an elimination match. This was not a Survivor Series-style match. Roderick Strong captained one team with Mark Briscoe, Moose, Cedric Alexander, and Matt Jackson of the Young Bucks against Jay Lethal's team of Jay Briscoe, Adam Page, Cliff Compton, and Cheeseburger, Chris Jericho's favorite wrestler at the moment. This was just nonstop action. Even Mark and Jay Briscoe at one point went at it. They were kicking each other in the face. They must have kicked each other in the face about 15 times before that finally got broken up. Later on, Roddy's team had Adam Page pinned after a 450 by Matt Jackson, but Cheeseburger, of all people, made the save. So Cheeseburger breaks up the pin. All of the members of Team Roddy now are standing in a circle. Cheeseburger gets up, he finds himself in the middle, and he's looking, he's got nowhere to go. And so he did what any smaller guy is taught when you go to prison, or at least that's what I've learned from watching movies. is that you go after the biggest guy first, and that's what he did. He caught Moose with a palm thrust. More palm strikes for Roddy and for Cedric. Moose, though, came back and speared the shit out of poor Cheeseburger. At this point, everybody went crazy with their finishes. Jay Lethal hit Moose with the Lethal Injection, but then Matt Jackson immediately caught Lethal with a super kick. Clotheslines, sick kicks, super kicks, brain busters, Michinoku drivers. Absolute mayhem. And Cliff Compton, who had set up a table outside the ring earlier in the match, and then the referee said, nope, you can't use it, get back in the ring, and it was just sitting there the whole time, and you knew, okay, that table is there for a reason. Compton climbs to the top rope, he gets super kicked by the young buck, and falls all the way down to the floor, crashing through the table. Great spot. Suplex into the backbreaker by Roddy to Adam Page, and then Mark Briscoe finished off Page with the Froggy Bow elbow off the top rope for the pin. Really, really fun stuff here. Very well done. Everybody gave Cheeseburger his props when the match was over. Members from both teams, they're going over, they're shaking his hand. I think Cheeseburger may be the most over guy in that entire promotion. It's insane. So next week they announce there's going to be a recap show, the best of 2015, so I'm not planning on doing a review next week. So whenever they come back with new matches, we'll get back to that. Let's take your mailbag questions now. If you have questions for me, you can email me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. Joel says, I have a little tweak to the idea that you talked about on last week's podcast about Triple H stripping Roman of the title and putting it up in the Royal Rumble, and I think I solved the problem of having him get screwed out of it again. Yeah, so what Joel is referring to is I talked about this last week. I kind of like the idea of them taking Roman's title and putting it up in the Rumble match. We haven't seen that since 92, and you can have all these big names in there, Roman and Dean and Cena and Triple H and Undertaker and Brock, and the championship is on the line. The reason why I was against the idea as much as I like it is because they've already screwed Roman so many times that to screw him again by taking the title off of him would be a huge mistake. You know, it's kind of like been there, done that. You can't take the belt off of him, especially now he's got some momentum. So this is Joel's solution to the problem. He says, what if, instead of stripping Roman Reigns, Triple H comes back and makes Roman defend his title in the Rumble itself, having Roman come in at number one, overcoming the odds, and proving he deserves to be the champion. The final two could even be Dean and Roman, giving us a preview of what's to come in a brother Roman versus brother Dean match for WrestleMania that we were denied, as we were denied with Goldust and Cody. Well, you had me there until the very end. I like your idea. First of all, they're not doing Roman versus Dean at WrestleMania, not with the two of them as babyfaces. And I've given up on the idea that one of them is going to turn. If they were going to do the turn, it would have been done by now. So we saw the babyface match between them already at Survivor Series. They finally have the crowd behind Roman. They're not going to split the crowd for him at WrestleMania. But I like your idea. I like the idea of Triple H having Roman Reigns enter the Rumble at number one, putting the title on the line so that conceivably anybody can win it. Here's my tweak to your idea. Here's what I would do to make that even better and to have it make sense in the context of the storyline. You have Triple H announce that not only is Roman going to have to defend the championship in the 30-man Rumble match, and he's going to come in at number one, Triple H throws his name in the hat for the Royal Rumble and says he's entering the Rumble at number 30. So that way you have another big name in the match in addition to all the other guys I mentioned before. I would fill it with a lot of big names. And you have the inevitable Reigns versus Triple H showdown at the very end, as predictable as it may be. I said this earlier, right? Predictable is not necessarily a bad thing. Right? Tanahashi and Okada, oh, it's so predictable. They've been building this and Okada's going to win. So what? It's a great story. It makes sense. Predictable is not always bad. Comes down to Reigns and Triple H. They have their big showdown at the very end. And believe me, nobody is going to want to see Triple H win that belt. Okay, you'll have some haters, just like, you know, Cena and everybody else. People are going to hate no matter what. But by and large, you're not going to have a crowd of people cheering for Triple H to win the championship. He may be the one guy that people actually do. You know what? And I have to give Sheamus some credit because nobody likes Sheamus. So in the Roman-Sheamus feud, by and large, Roman was cheered and Sheamus was booed because nobody wants to see Sheamus with the fucking belt. I think Triple H kind of shares that same quality about him. I don't think that anybody wants to see Triple H be the champion again. And so you've got Roman now having the crowd fully behind him and the idea that he's going to, beat Triple H, and he overcomes the odds and he retains the title. That, to me, is what would make that Rumble really mean something, and I think that would be the best idea to go with. And I hope that's the direction that they're going in, and they're not going to strip him or do something stupid like that. And again, it doesn't even have to be Triple H making the announcement. They've got Vince. Vince is back on Raw tomorrow night. Now, maybe he's just going to be there to announce Sheamus' rematch, but maybe he's going to be there to tell Roman, hey, look, you're going to have to put that title on the line of the Rumble. I mean, that to me is what I would like to see them do. AJ from Arizona. Do you think people are overrating Nikki Bella's improvement? I've seen Bella fans all over social media constantly praise her as if she's the greatest wrestler alive, disregard everyone else's opinion, and smugly dismiss valid criticisms of her title reign and booking as being, quote, haters that hate their lives. You mean you're not a member of the Bella army, AJ? I propose that if we send ground troops into Syria to fight ISIS, we send the Bella army. Yes, Nikki has improved. Both of them have. I mean, Brie has improved as well from where she used to be. I think more so Nikki. She's worked very hard. Now, is she afforded certain opportunities because of who she's dating? Probably. I think that's, that's just how these things go. But it's kind of like Triple H. Some people say the only reason that Triple H became a big star was because he married the boss's daughter. Look, I don't doubt that Triple H dating Stephanie and his relationship with Vince that he had already had, even before he started going out with Stephanie, I don't doubt that that's helped out Triple H a lot in his career. And he had Vince's ear in a way that the guys he worked with probably didn't. And that benefited him. But that doesn't mean that Triple H didn't work his ass off and that he would not have been a big star anyway. Same kind of thing with Nikki. But yes, people do overrate her. She's not on the level even of most of the women that come out of NXT who have far less experience than her. She's just not. She's not on their level. She's not on the level of a Becky Lynch. She's not on the level of a Sasha Banks. I mean, she's just not, and she's not going to go down as the greatest anything. I don't care how many days she held that title. How many truly memorable Divas title matches can you name me during her reign as champion? How many really stand out to you? I mean, when she actually defended the title on TV, which was rare. It's a rare occurrence. I mean, Brock Lesnar didn't defend his title very often either. But Nikki Bella is no Brock Lesnar. People weren't exactly tuning in or buying tickets to see Nikki Bella defend her Divas Championship. And by the way, Pro Wrestling Sheet broke some news this weekend that Nikki is going to be out of action for a while. She's going to be out for several more months, probably, and she may even need surgery. I guess her neck is just not healing as well as she would like, and it all stems from her rack attack finish. Not that she has, not that her giant rack is resulting in neck pain, but, the movement of, picking somebody up over your head and then slamming down. Effectively, the person is coming down with their weight on her neck and her shoulders, and I guess it just puts a lot of stress on her neck, and so it might be wise for her to find a new move when she comes back. And I hope she gets well. I mean, I don't wish ill on her, and, neck problems, that sucks. I don't wish ill on her at all, but just to go back to AJ's original question, yeah, I think she is overrated in a lot of ways by a lot of people. Even though she's gotten better, she is by no means the end-all be-all, and like I said, she will not go down as the greatest anything. Chris from Green Bay, Wisconsin. If you were in charge of WWE and had the power to sign any non-WWE talent currently wrestling to try to boost Raw ratings, who would you go after? I don't think there's any one person that could really make that much of a difference. That's kind of where we are now. Look at the people that WWE has brought back on TV in the last few months. They brought, even when Brock is around, Undertaker, they brought back Stone Cold Steve Austin, Shawn Michaels, Ric Flair. Nobody really seems to make a difference like they used to. But there would be value, I think, in bringing Jeff Hardy back from TNA. Jeff's already got one foot out the door there anyway. If you heard some of the comments he's made in interviews recently, So it's only a matter of time before he's back in WWE. It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. He was on Ric Flair's podcast. He said he and Matt would like to end their careers in WWE. He said he's got two things on his bucket list that he would like to cross off. One of them is working a Hell in a Cell match. Apparently he's never been in one of those before. And the other is headlining a WrestleMania. And so he'll be back in WWE, but the question is when. It could be a long time. His leg is still fucked from that dirt bike accident. He had surgery on the leg. He still has to have knee surgery early next year. He says that once he does, that surgery is going to probably keep him out for most of 2016. So, again, I think he'll be back, but it may not be. Honestly, we may be looking at a Jeff Hardy return right around the time that Randy Orton comes back. If Randy Orton ends up having fusion surgery on his neck, which is the rumor, he may need fusion surgery. It could be 2017 before Randy Orton is back. He's still healing up from, possibly healing up from shoulder surgery. I think if he had the surgery, he would still be healing up from it. He can't have any neck surgery until he's healed up from that. So I think even Randy Orton, we may not see him at all next year wrestle a match. So I guess we'll see who makes it back to WWE first, Randy Orton or Jeff Hardy. Ben from Winchester, England. Lots of people are discussing the possibility of Finn Balor being Hideo Itami's attacker, leading to a Balor heel turn. But I was thinking it could be more surprising and interesting if Hideo returned, took out whoever his attacker was, whether it's Corbin, Joe, or whoever, and then turned heel against Balor anyway. Hideo acting more vicious in order to make up for time he's lost and jump the line to number one contender. Which do you think would be better, a Hideo heel turn or a Balor heel turn? They're not turning Balor before he makes the main roster, so let's just get that straight. I would prefer Balor, though, be the one to go heel, because I think he needs a change right now to make him a little more interesting. Maybe they do a deal where it was the demon who attacked Finn. Anything to make that demon character a little bit different from just normal Finn. I like the idea of the fans getting behind Hideo. They were really getting behind this guy before he got hurt. The timing was just so shitty. And again, I have no doubt at that Beast in the East special in July, that was Hideo's spot. It would have been him winning the championship in Japan. It would have been a huge moment. I think they were going to save the first GTS probably on TV for that match against Owens. I mean, I saw him use the GTS on Tyler Breeze WrestleMania weekend, but that show never aired on TV. Right? And they teased it on TV a lot of times. It's not like they were shying away from the move just because Punk used to use it. And remember, Punk took the move from him. It's his move. And they would tease it, and they would tease, and everybody would slip out, and we never got to see the big payoff. So I have no doubt in my mind they were saving that for the network special in Japan in July. But even go back to WrestleMania weekend. Remember that great special they aired on Hideo? It's like his journey to WrestleMania because he won a spot in the Andre Battle Royal and got fucking jobbed out of that thing. But they put that, like, I think it was like an hour long or half an hour, whatever it was. It was a great special. It really, I mean, I don't see how you can watch that and not like the guy. And he never did, get to have, the big payoff and the big moment. So you tell the story of him trying to come back from the injury, wanting revenge on Balor for the betrayal, and costing him 8 months of his career. And then you build to that moment where he finally hits the GTS and he wins the championship. That's how I would do it. I just don't see them turning Balor heel before he makes the main roster. I think they want him and that entrance and everything. They want him to be this big ultra babyface when he comes up. And I don't think there's enough time for them to turn him heel and then ultimately turn him back babyface and then promote him to the main roster. I don't know when he's going to get called up. I would think it's going to be sometime next year. And I just can't see them turning him heel before then. But if it were me, I would do it. I would not want Itami to be the heel in this feud. I would want to keep that babyface momentum he had going and build to his big moment that he was denied. Roberto from Queens. I was watching an episode of Nitro where Lex Luger was facing Hollywood Hogan for the WCW title and won. Afterward, the whole locker room emptied out to celebrate, and it was treated as a monumental moment. However, 6 days later, Luger would drop the belt back to Hogan, and it was back to status quo. Do you have any insight on why they gave the title to Luger 6 days before the pay-per-view, only for Hogan to win it back? just to spice things up a little bit heading into the pay-per-view. Now, Lex Luger was not winning the championship from Hogan at the Road Wild show. Hogan was always going to have the belt coming out of that pay-per-view, so you know, it was just done to make things exciting. I think that may have been... I think that go-home show to the pay-per-view may have been the 100th episode of Nitro. So, you know, it may have just been something they wanted to do to make that night a special night. Hey, it's the 100th episode of Nitro. I don't know how hard they promoted that fact on TV. I don't remember. And maybe I'm completely wrong. I think it was the 100th show. So that may have had as much to do with it as anything. But, you know, the thing is, they could not keep the title on Luger because the big money match was with Sting. Sting was the one who had to be the one to take the title from Hogan and beat the NWO. I mean, they were building that fucking thing up the entire year. So, you know, if you want to put the championship on Luger and then take it right back from him, fine. It was a great little moment, and the good guy should get a win. You've got to throw them a bone every now and then. But it actually made sense to not keep it on Luger longer than that, because if Luger just wins the belt, then he's the champ, and he holds it for a month or two. It takes some of the edge off, ultimately, that big Sting win at Starrcade. Although, hindsight being what it is, WCW did a good enough job on their own taking the fucking edge off that Sting win. What a fucking disaster that turned out to be. Danny wants to know, I once heard Shane McMahon tried to convince his dad to buy UFC in 2000. Is there any truth to this? And would MMA be as big now if WWE had purchased UFC? That is a true story. I think Dana White has admitted it. Shane wanted them to buy it so that he could run it, and Vince shot the idea down. This was when UFC was in pretty bad shape. They were still banned from pay-per-view, and it was still very underground. This was years before The Ultimate Fighter debuted. They were very close to going out of business, UFC was, probably. I think it was around that time. And how different would things be now? Very different. WWE does not have a very good track record with things other than the WWE product. And a lot of people would say they don't even have a good track record with that anymore, even though they're still making money hand over fist. We don't know how Shane would have done running a mixed martial arts company. It almost, you know, it almost doesn't even matter. The minute that WWE would have bought UFC, it would have killed the sport. Or at least it would have killed UFC, because people would automatically assume they're going to fix the fights, right? That and the fact that the only way they know is the WWE way of doing things. They don't know how to run a legitimate sporting company. They don't know how to run a legitimate sporting event. They don't want to run a legitimate sporting event. They want to run entertainment shows, and they want to make movies. So really, the best thing that ever happened to UFC is Vince McMahon, because A, he said no to his son, and B, he said yes when USA Network asked for his blessing to air The Ultimate Fighter on Raw on Monday nights. That's what gave rise to UFC as we know it today. You could thank Vince McMahon for that. Tyler from McHenry, Illinois, was WCW Starrcade 1997 the beginning of the end of WCW? Some people say it was, but in my opinion, I really don't think so. Not by a long shot. If you look at the ratings, they never dropped or swung in WWE's favor. By the night after WrestleMania 14, WCW was still killing them, and it wasn't until 2 weeks later that WWE finally won a week in the ratings. How was it the end when they were still beating Raw during that time? Also, if you fast forward to August, September of 98, Nitro beat Raw 7 out of 8 times in those 2 months. When somebody says that was the beginning of the end for something, it doesn't mean it was instant. Okay, I wouldn't say Starrcade 97 was the beginning of the end. I would say Starrcade 98 was the beginning of the end. Having Kevin Nash and Goldberg streak was the beginning of the end for WCW. Bobby Heenan even told Tony Schiavone the same thing, and Tony told him, hey, you're crazy. And again, I'm sure ratings didn't tank the very next night. They were still competitive. They were still making money. But once they killed the streak, and they didn't have another attraction like a Goldberg, they didn't have anybody else, anyone new waiting in the wings, and they killed the one golden goose that they had, that was it. That was the beginning. It was one of many things that killed that company, but that, to me, is what you can trace it back to. The finger poke of doom the next week, or whenever it was, you know, that was just, you know what that was? You know what the finger poke was? If Nash ending Goldberg's streak was the nail going into the coffin, the finger poke of doom was the hammer hitting the nail. That's the analogy I would use. And they still could have turned it around. You know, they had at least a fighting chance. They still could have busted open the casket lid. But the point of no return for them, and I've said this before, was April of 2000 when they brought back Bischoff and they brought back Russo to work together. And I think that same month is when they put the title on David Arquette. Okay, that was the point of no return. The ball was already rolling down the hill, okay, stemming from what happened at Starrcade. That was the beginning of the end. It was still a fighting chance until that happened, until April of 2000. The point is, the end did not come suddenly for WCW. They died a slow, painful death. That's what's meant by the beginning of the end. It's called the beginning for a reason. Danny, was Mark Eaton just a timekeeper in WWE, or did he also have other roles and responsibilities within the company? I still can't believe they let that guy go. I mean, he was up there with Howard Finkel as one of the longest tenured employees in the company, and they fired him last year. I don't know exactly what they had him doing beyond timekeeping. I'm almost positive he was helping out in other ways before the shows. I don't think he just showed up to ring the damn bell. Back in the day, the timekeeper back then would signal time cues to the referee. But now all the referees wear earpieces, and they have for years. So I don't know if they do any of that stuff anymore. The biggest thing he did was he was the guy who threw Stone Cold all of his beers. He was Steve Austin's official beer thrower. And let me tell you something, that guy had impeccable aim with those throws. He should go into the Hall of Fame just for that, and they should have Austin do the induction. Kenny from Texas. My question is about the match between Undertaker and John Cena from the 2003 Vengeance pay-per-view. Why did Undertaker walk to the ring when he rode his bike out on the ramp? Some say it was due to his bike stalling, but I've heard other reports that he just wanted to walk at the last minute to change things up. Which was it? His bike stalled. That's what happened. You could see him trying to start it up, and it wouldn't start. And I think they even took the camera off him for a while he was trying, but yeah, he played it cool, and he walked to the ring instead. I remember seeing that on a blooper video somebody put together on YouTube. It seemed pretty obvious to me that the bike stalled, but, you know, Undertaker handled it like a pro. Dave from Windsor, Canada. My question is about the Iron Man match at WrestleMania 12. Do you think the moment when Shawn wins is tarnished due to the fact that the match went into overtime? It would have meant much more had they... And they kind of burnt the crowd out. I'm not sure if this was Brett's call or Vince's, but it's something I really get frustrated with, considering the fact that it went another minute and a half. Yes. He had 60 minutes to beat the champion, and he couldn't do it. You know how many guys went to one-hour draws with Ric Flair back in the day, and they didn't win the NWA title? Why does Shawn Michaels get special treatment? They never said, oh, if this match goes to a draw, we go to sudden death. They fucking made the rules up as they went along. Brett had every right to be upset. Whatever happened to the champion's advantage? Forget Montreal. This was the first real screw job on Bret Hart. Speaking of Montreal, Chris, which controversy hurt their respective company the most? The screw job in 1997 or the Bash at the Beach 2000 incident with Hulk Hogan and Vince Russo? Well, seeing as how Montreal helped create the Mr. McMahon character, and seeing as how Montreal led to a period of great prosperity for that company, and WCW was dead 6 months after the Hogan incident, I would say that I think the Bash at the Beach thing was probably worse. And I think Eric Bischoff mentioned in the interview he did with JBL on the network, he did like a two-part interview with him, and that came up, and I think Bischoff said that Hogan won a settlement against WCW because there was a lawsuit, and I think Hogan won a settlement for like a few million dollars or $5 million or something like that. So, yeah, I mean, the Bash at the Beach incident did not, if you put that on a list of things that killed WCW, I don't even think it would be on the list. If it is, it's at the very bottom. That didn't directly kill the company or anything, but I would say the Bash at the Beach incident did far more damage than the Montreal screwjob did. Joe from Oklahoma City. Buy or sell Kalisto's Salida del Sol on Jey Uso at TLC or Edge's spear off the ladder on Jeff Hardy at WrestleMania 17. Edge's spear was epic, amazing, and dangerous. It will forever be replayed. Time will tell if Kalisto's spot will be remembered as much, but the dangers of the flip onto another ladder cannot be overlooked. I don't know what I'm buying or selling here. I mean, if you're asking me which one was more crazy and dangerous, I'm going with the Salida del Sol, because you have a guy flipping backwards in midair. I mean, I know the ladder he was on was not quite as tall as the ladder that Edge jumped off of, although Edge wasn't at the very top of that ladder. But it was still pretty frickin' high. And you got a guy flipping backwards in midair from that high up and landing ass first on a ladder, even if it was a gimmicked ladder. I don't know if it was or not. But still landing ass first on a ladder, there's so many things that can go wrong with that. And he landed it perfectly. Even Jey Uso, he had to fall backwards onto the ladder. But it's that backwards flip on the move from that high up that's so dangerous. You know, the Edge spear was also very dangerous. Edge, like I said, he was on a taller ladder, and he came down right on his knees. I mean, go back and watch it. He landed right on his knees. And Jeff Hardy's taken some crazy bumps in his day. He got folded up like an accordion. But I'm going to give it to Kalisto. I think the Kalisto thing was more, like I said, both were dangerous, but I think it was more dangerous, and I think it was even more spectacular because of the flip. What kills it for me, though, and I think why the Edge spear is going to be forever replayed, and this one probably won't be, is that that happened at WrestleMania. This one didn't. And the fact that Edge and Jeff Hardy had Jim Ross calling that spot makes it that much more epic. I don't know if it was Xavier Woods or JBL. I don't know who to blame for this, but on that spot, after he nailed the Salida del Sol, somebody on commentary at TLC kept saying, "What? What? 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 What?" over and over and over again. Like five or six times they channeled their inner Steve Austin during that spot, and it was fucking annoying. Again, I don't know if it was Woods, because I think Woods had a headset on, or maybe it was JBL, but oh my God, you compare the two? There is no comparison. On the spot itself, though, I'm buying on Kalisto. I just think that was insane. Jimmy from York, Pennsylvania. Buy or sell? Kevin Owens as WWE Champion or Sami Zayn as WWE Champion? I think at least one of these two will be the champion one day. Who has the better chance of winning it? And then he put hashtag son of Adonis, bro. I think both of them are going to be champions someday, but I'm buying on Owens winning it first, and I'm selling on Sami. Sami, though, I could see Sami Zayn being that scrappy underdog like Daniel Bryan was, and winning the fans over the way that Bryan did. They have very similar styles. Both spent over a decade working indies all over the world. Both are great wrestlers. Both are not much to necessarily look at compared to the other guys they have on that roster. And they're great baby faces. You know, Zayn, I think Sami Zayn's actually a better talker. I know he's a better talker than Bryan is, and I think that's going to work to his advantage. So many guys come up and they're not that great. They don't really know how to speak for themselves. Sami Zayn doesn't have that problem. You know, it's like once they took the mask off this guy and he started talking, you know, he doesn't shut up, but he's good. He's really, really good. Remember, you know, Bryan, I get the sense that Sami Zayn also would be more willing to fight for his spot and ruffle some feathers more than Daniel Bryan would. Bryan once scored lower than anyone else in the history of that company on this ambition test that I guess they give people. Zayn, I mean, I don't know him, but I don't think that's who he is. I think he's very much driven and will speak up if he thinks he has to, or if maybe things aren't going his way or something. I mean, maybe that works to his detriment in the end. Maybe in the end that's the thing that kills him. I don't know, but I just think Sami Zayn can be over huge the way Bryan was as the babyface champion, and then you can feud him and Kevin Owens. I mean, what was it they said back when they were in Ring of Honor? Like, we're destined to do this forever? Well, you know what? That could end up being an all-time great feud when all is said and done in this company. Time for our WCW countdown. Remember, we're spanning only WCW era matches here. We're not counting Jim Crockett Promotions. We're doing one match per week in no particular order for 15 straight weeks leading into the 15-year anniversary of the final Nitro and the death of WCW. This is match number 2 of 15 from Spring Stampede, April 17th, 1994. In Chicago, Illinois, it was the WCW World Tag Team Champions, the Nasty Boys, against Cactus Jack and Max Payne in a Chicago street fight. Tony Schiavone and Bobby Heenan on the call. I'm not entirely sure if this is for the tag team titles or not, since Schiavone made the comment at the beginning of the match that this isn't about the tag team titles. But I think it is a championship match. This is a match that, after all of these years, this was over 20 years ago, and we've seen a lot of crazy matches with guys using garbage can lids and weapons and stuff. I mean, I think to the point where we're all kind of numb to it at this point. I made the comment a few weeks ago when we saw the Team ECW guys and the Dudleys and them. They had that great Extreme Rules match on Raw. It was so different than what we're used to seeing on Raw these days that I enjoyed it. But a lot of those like garbage type matches, I'm like desensitized to it. So this holds up after all these years. But what made this work is you didn't see a match like this back then in WCW or WWF. You just didn't see matches like this. ECW became known for matches like this, but that was after this. You might even say this match is what led to ECW booking hardcore matches like this one. So to give some background here, Cactus and Payne, they'd been teaming up for a few months by this point. They and the Nasty Boys had already had a couple of matches together, one at the Clash of the Champions show in January, again at Super Brawl in February. Cactus and Payne won both of those matches. The last one they won by DQ. There would be no disqualifications in this match here on the Spring Stampede show. This was a Chicago street fight, which meant anything goes, false count anywhere in the building. The point of this countdown is not to give you the play-by-play. I'm not going to give you the blow-by-blow, move-for-move stuff, which is good, because I wouldn't be able to do it here anyway. Okay, it was only a 9-minute match. It was not that long. But it was nonstop action from start to finish. Exactly the kind of match you would want to see these two teams have. Just like the Wyatts and Team ECW. I said the same thing, right? I don't want to see those guys go out there and do lockups and drop toe holds. I want to see a fight. And that's exactly what we got here. This was really the year 94 was that Mick Foley cemented his hardcore status. The month before this, he tore his ear off in a match with Vader in Germany. Okay, the infamous match. He wrestled this match here with his ear, or what used to be his ear, all bandaged up. There's a giant bandage on the side of his head. And the announcers made mention of it at one point that he was planning on having surgery to reattach the ear. So they were trying to protect it. Well, as it turned out, he was booked for another tag team title match at the Slamboree show the month after this. And basically Foley was forced to choose between either having the surgery or wrestling for the tag team titles. Well, guess what he chose? Suffice to say, he never did get that surgery. It was supposed to be, ear reconstruction surgery. Never had it. So here he is anyway in this match, bandage over the ear, taking some sick chair shots to the head. Shots with a pool cue that Brian Knobbs found laying around somewhere. They were brawling all over the place. They had to do a split screen just so we could see what the hell was going on. There was a fake merchandise stand that WCW set up next to the stage. It was hilarious how obviously phony it was because of where it was situated. It was all gated off. Like, who would even be allowed over there to go buy a t-shirt, right? There's no fans over there. And yet there it was. Max Payne body slammed Knobs through the table with all the merch on it and then tried shoving one of the t-shirts down his throat the way that Ted DiBiase used to shove $100 bills down people's throats. Tony Schiavone said, "I don't even think that shirt fits him." So, great insight there from Tony. Cactus Jack was thrown into the steel guardrail, did a flip over it onto the pavement. This would not be the sickest bump he would take onto the pavement in this match. Foley did use a table for a pretty innovative spot. He used it as a weapon, suplexing the table backwards right onto Jerry Sags, who was laying on the ground. This was on the ramp. WCW was using those ramps at the time that stretched all the way from the stage to the ring. TNA started using them for a while after Hogan and Bischoff came in, so I guess it was a Bischoff idea. Knobs found a snow shovel somewhere. First the pool cue, now a snow shovel. And as soon as Cactus Jack got up after dropping that table across Sags, Knobs came running. I don't know, he just, like a bat out of hell, he came from out of nowhere, and he caught Foley with a snow shovel shot to the face. That was just too brutal for words. And again, not the worst snow shovel shot that Foley would take in the face during this match. Somewhere in here, They brought another table up on the ramp, and Sags climbs on top of it. He tries to give Cactus Jack a pile driver. The table collapses under their weight. They all fall down. Then came two of the sickest bumps of, well, not even two of the two sickest bumps of the match, and two of the absolute sickest bumps I've ever seen, which puts this match over the top. I mean, it was already crazy and wild. This just put this match over the top. Sags and Cactus, they both stand up. Okay, they just botched the pile driver through the table. So now they stand up. They're on the ramp. The camera is focused on Knobs and Max Payne. Okay, they're brawling a little further down the ramp. But in the background, we can see Sags and we can see Cactus Jack. They're kind of off in the distance. And you see in the background, Sags just... Cactus is just standing there, and Sags just gives him a shove. And Foley falls backwards off the ramp, which is probably about, I don't know, 4 or 5 feet up, maybe. Off the ramp, completely unprotected, no mats down below or anything. There's really just a small gap between the ramp and the you know, the metal barricade. And he hits the pavement full force. I screamed, oh my God, when I saw that. And it's not like I haven't seen this match before. It's been a while, but I've seen it. And I still screamed when I saw this. And Tony Schiavone just goes, he goes, Cactus Jack, I don't think is going to get up. It's like, no shit. No shit, he's not going to get up. And as if that wasn't brutal enough, Knobs takes the snow shovel. Okay, he tosses it down below because Sags climbs down off the ramp. So Knobs tosses him the snow shovel. He picks it up and he smacks Cactus Jack in the face with it. About as hard as you could possibly swing a snow shovel. Hard enough that it was uncomfortable to watch. He covers Cactus, gets the pin, and I just don't know what to say about this other than just, wow. And then, as Gary Michael Capetta is announcing the Nasty Boys as the winners, Sags comes running down the ramp. We see him in the background. He picks up like the broken table leg, okay? So in the foreground, we see Max Payne with his back turned. And in the background, we see Sags picking up this piece of the table, and he comes charging at Max Payne. And he mows down Max Payne with this table, with this piece of the table, knocks him out. This is the most fun I've had watching a match in a long time, and I feel guilty saying that, seeing the abuse that these guys took, especially Foley. How he's even coherent at this age, let alone writing books and blogs after all the bumps that he's taken, I have no idea, but God bless the guy. I can say this much, though. It was never boring. There was not a dull moment during this match. It was short, but it was memorable. Everybody needs to see this match. The match that the Nasties had with Cactus and Kevin Sullivan at Slamboree the month after this was equally chaotic, but it kind of felt like they were just trying to replicate what they did here. There were some issues between Max Payne and Jerry Sags during the match. Sags got hurt. He hurt his shoulder. I don't know if he broke it or separated it or whatever. And apparently Max Payne got chewed out for it backstage by Eric Bischoff when he came through the curtain. So, again, this guy's out there. He's having this insanely brutal match, best match on the show, and taking all this abuse. And he walks through the curtain and he gets chewed out by Eric Bischoff for hurting Sags, which is rich to me, because you look at the way the Nasty Boys wrestled in this match and most of their matches and how reckless they seemed and how stiff they were. And, you know, one of them gets hurt and the other guy gets chewed out. So anyway, he got chewed out, but apparently he gave it right back to Bischoff, and that was he didn't get fired on the spot or anything like that, but that was kind of the beginning of the end of his push in WCW. He ended up in WWF the year after. He was Man Mountain Rock. He didn't last very long. He had some drug issues. And years ago, the only thing I've heard about him recently is he put out a trailer, which may still be up on YouTube. I don't know. This was many years ago. He was planning to release a movie, almost like a home movie that he shot, with all of this footage from... He has his own like personal video camera. And he shot footage on one of the WWF European tours in 1995. So it had footage on there of, like, Yokozuna and Kevin Nash and Rad Radford and Owen Hart and Bob Holly and Sid and Bam Bam and all these people, you know, behind the scenes. And there was one shot of, they were on like a tour bus, I guess, in Europe. And Nash and a bunch of the guys, Yokozuna, they're all sitting around. And Nash is like holding up a bunch of pill bottles. And there was supposedly a lot of really salacious stuff on there. I don't think the movie was ever released. It was like a, 3-minute trailer with like music in the background and all these clips. And that was it. I never heard anything about it again. The movie never came out. I wish it did. I'd love to take a look at it. That was the last I ever heard of Max Payne and what he was what he's up to now. I have no idea. Foley obviously went on to bigger and better things, but yeah, this is a match that to me stands up after all these years and may be the craziest match that WCW has ever had. So that's match number two. We'll do number three next weekend as our countdown continues here on the show. Follow me on Twitter at Solomonster, and don't forget to vote in our Raw poll every Monday night as soon as the show goes off the air. I will put that poll up, thumbs down. Now would be a good time to subscribe to our YouTube channel. It's just the full name of the show, Solomonster Sounds Off. Type it in, you'll find it. Hit the subscribe button. I may have a New Year's surprise for all of you up there later this week. I don't want to say any more than that right now, but now would be a good time to head on over there and hit the subscribe button. Next weekend on the show, we will have a preview of the Wrestle Kingdom 10 show coming up from the Tokyo Dome on January 4th. And my plan at this point is to do predictions for 2016, save them for next week's show. So that should be a lot of fun. I just want to say here, this is the last show of the year, and I want to take a moment here to thank everybody who has listened to any of my shows this year, any new fans that we've been able to pick up, people who have donated to the show, who have used our Audible link, bought a t-shirt on Pro Wrestling Tees, even just shared our links, retweeted our stuff on Twitter. Any way that you've supported me in this podcast, I want to just say thank you, 2015. As crappy a year personally as it was for me, it was kind of the polar opposite in terms of the podcast. It was our best year yet. And the show continues to grow by leaps and bounds, and we have as many listeners now as we ever have, and I want to keep that going in 2016, and you guys are a big part of that. You just got to keep spreading the word and letting people know. That's the best thing I could ask you to do. But yeah, I just wanted to say thank you for all of your support and helping to make this our biggest and best year yet. And here's hopefully to even bigger and better things in 2016. So until next time, be well, stay safe. Please have yourselves a very safe and happy new year. I will see you right back here for more Sound Off next year. Until then, take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solomonster Sounds Off.
Hulk Hogan's WCW contract splattered all over the internet. He got a $2 million signing bonus, 25% of the ticket revenue from all Nitro and Thunder events that he appeared on. He also got $20,000 per month for as long as he was part of the NWO, 50% of the profits from any Hulk Hogan merchandise that was sold, and a minimum $675,000 for any pay-per-view he appeared on. You know what I say? I say good for him. If I could get that kind of deal for myself, if somebody wanted me that badly, they were that stupid, then great. Always ask for what you feel you're worth. Your boss should have the guts to say no. WCW wanted to blow this guy so badly, they put a towel down on the floor so they wouldn't get rug burned.
Solomonster Sounds Off.
Since 2007, the Solomonster Sounds Off. Available at thesolomonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solomonster Sound Off.